from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I think most people expect to find a nice, quiet pond in the woods, as Thoreau writes about in his book Walden. But today, Walden's a busy place. Most people are very surprised at the numbers we do attract in our visitation. Most people are very surprised about the pond itself, how large it actually is. In the book, it seems to be much smaller than it's described and as people imagine.
150 years after the publication of Henry David Thoreau's Walden, thousands of visitors now flock to the site, where Thoreau built his tiny cabin in the woods in Concord, Massachusetts in 1845. They come now from around the world and from neighboring towns. On private pilgrimages, family vacations, school field trips, they swim in the pond, walk in the woods, many clearly hoping to sense for a moment the wild and quiet, earthy and transcendent insights Thoreau described at Walden Pond. Thoreau's classic work of Man and Nature was no great success in his lifetime. Today, it's a global icon on a planet of hard-pressed nature. We're not looking, though, for a plaster saint tonight, but for a vital, searching writer on a real pond and his astonishing resonance across a century and a half. Tonight on Point, revisiting Henry David Thoreau's Walden, 150 years on. Joining me now in the studio is Jeffrey Kramer, curator at the Thoreau Institute at Walden Woods and editor of the new book, Thoreau's Walden, a fully annotated edition. Jeffrey Kramer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
As we hear the sounds of Walden Wood and that friendly ranger retreating in the background. Also with us is Lawrence Buell, professor of American Literature at Harvard University and author of several books about Thoreau, including The Environmental Imagination, Thoreau, Nature Writing, and the Formation of American Culture. Sounds grand. Lawrence Buell, great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So here we are. There's never a bad time to talk about Thoreau. 150 years, why not? And he's still so incredibly on people's minds. Maybe the best way to begin is just to hear a little bit of the kind of text that works people up so much today. You can tell us in a moment, Jeff Kramer, how much it worked them up in the mid-19th century. Let's just listen to a little bit of Thoreau's Walden from the chapter Where I Lived and What I Lived For.
I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner, and reduce it to its lowest terms.
And reduce it to its lowest terms, wrote Henry David Thoreau in a book that came out 150 years ago, Walden. And, of course, Jeff Kramer, he goes on to say there, and then to find out, what is it worth when you cut it all the way down, you scrape it all the way down to nature? Is it mean or is it exalted? Who was this young man in his late 20s when he went into the woods for 2 years? Who was Henry David Thoreau?
Well, he was a man that was searching. He was asking questions. He went to Walden Pond, actually, to write a book about excursion he took with his brother John, who had died. And so he went there to write a book called The Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, not to write Walden, which is a popular misconception. But while he was living there, he asked himself questions about how to live his life and what was really important in his life. And so over a nine-year period, as he expanded the manuscript of Walden, he wrote the book that we've come to know.
How much was written in that teensy cabin that he built there in the woods, and how much was written over the many years before it was actually published?
Less than half was written at Walden. He was giving lectures about why he was living at the woods. He called it History of Myself. And so there were two drafts, early drafts of Walden written there, but everything else was done later, and most of the expansions happened around 1851.
Now, this was not just anybody from any context who was going into the woods. I mean, he'd actually lived with Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great transcendentalist, as a handyman around his house for a year or two. He very much grew up in that transcendentalist culture. Describe that for us and how it shows up in his work.
Well, when he graduated from Harvard and went back home to Concord, he did live with the Emersons for a while, and he was greatly influenced by Emerson. They came to different kind of relationship later on as Thoreau's own ideas grew. But he was searching for a meaning, and a lot of what he was looking for comes directly out of Emerson. A lot of his early influences came from Emerson. So when he went to Walden and when he was trying to discover what was important in his life, He's trying to enact, in many ways, the things that, Emerson was writing about.
And then give us just the physical details, because the modern kind of urban legend is that, oh, you know, Thoreau actually went home and watched video games every weekend, and he did all his laundry at his mom's house and practically got TV dinners. I mean, he wasn't on a wild frontier here. He was within sight of a train track at one end of Walden Pond and walking distance, a mile or so of home. What was his interaction with the nearby outside world as he hunkered down at Walden Pond?
He had a lot of interaction. He was not a hermit. He went into town not quite daily, but several times a week. He would go to the post office. He would pick up the newspaper. He would meet with friends, visit family. Lots of people would come out to Walden to visit him. Children particularly loved to visit Thoreau, who would take them on nature walks or boat rides out on the pond. So he was not living a secluded life whatsoever, and he doesn't really imply that in Walden, although people have read that into the book.
Just that he was close enough to nature in a new relationship for him to use it as a kind of a sounding board for all these insights.
Right.
Lawrence Buell, then take us in. What is it that that Henry David Thoreau brought out of those woods? It wasn't a popular book in his lifetime. Only 2,000 copies are sold, as I recall, while he was alive. Now, everyone around the world knows it. Mahatma Gandhi cited it as an inspiration. Martin Luther King, many others, the entire American conservation movement. What was crystallized or captured there that became and continues to be so potent now?
Not one single thing. That passage that was read before shows that Thoreau's commitments and his attractions were multiple. Separating out from the herd, finding what's essentially true rather than what's been told to me is true. That contrarian side of Thoreau is one of his great legacies and the reason for Gandhi, for Martin Luther King, picking up on Thoreau in latter days. Of course, they knew not only Walden, but the great essay on civil disobedience and Thoreau's acts of disobedience.
That he actually wrote during the time he was living at the cabin, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
1846, I think.
He certainly had the experience of the night in jail while he was at the pond. He wrote civil disobedience around 1847 when he was lecturing about it.
Okay.
There are other legacies, too. Again, in that same passage that was read, the idea of a voluntary simplicity, finding out what life's essentials are, not to be a self-denying monk or hermit, but to lead a richer life as a result. That's been a strong counterculture in the United States over against the dominant consumer culture that was starting up in Thoreau's own time, which was the takeoff point of the Industrial Revolution that still we live within. The fact that Thoreau was a darn good writer.
He sure was, and
has,
just amazing.
A force in and of itself. It doesn't necessarily get recognized at the moment that you publish what you do, but it has a lasting effect. And then finally, there is the green Thoreau, the man who's thought of as always having lived in the woods, even though he says he left it at the end of the story. It's hard to imagine him any other place. And as the condition of our physical environment worsens, we become more aware of its endangerment. Thoreau looks like a prophet. A green saint in advance of his day.
He sure does, and he reads like a fairly divine writer as well. Let's hear just a little bit more. This also from the chapter Where I Lived and What I Lived For from Thoreau's Walden.
Time is but a stream I go a-fishing in. I drink at it, but while I drink, I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper, fish in the sky whose bottom is pebbly with stars. I cannot count one. I know not the first letter of the alphabet. I've always been regretting that I was not as wise as the day I was born. The intellect is a cleaver. It discerns and rifts its way into the secret of things. I do not wish to be any more busy with my hands than is necessary. My head is hands and feet. I feel all my best faculties concentrated in it. My instinct tells me that my head is an organ for burrowing, as some creatures use their snout and forepaws, and with it I would mine and burrow my way through these hills. I think that the richest vein is somewhere hereabouts. So by the divining rod and thin rising vapors, I judge, and here I will begin to mine.
Henry David Thoreau from Walden. We're talking tonight about Thoreau's Walden on its 150th anniversary of its publication. I'm joined by Jeff Kramer, curator at the Thoreau Institute at Walden Woods, by Lawrence Buell, professor of American literature at Harvard University, and now also joining us in the studio, David Gessner. He is a self-described reluctant nation writer, author of The Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder, Under the Devil's Thumb, A Wild Rank Place, and most recently, Sick of Nature. He's an assistant professor in the creative writing program at the University of North Carolina, editor of the forthcoming literary journal Ecotone. David Gessner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we've got a lot to talk about. We want to dig in. We want to hear your favorite passages from all of you here as we talk about Thoreau. But you've got this wonderful kind of contrarian take on at least the heirs of Henry David Thoreau. When Larry Buell describes him as the Green Saint, stick out and are whacking folks who have taken the saint thing too far.
Well, I'm also whacking the people who have reduced what Larry called the many faces of Thoreau to the one. When it's just the Green Saint, that's when it gets on my nerves. It's when we suddenly have the saintly voice and we suddenly have the hushed tones and the over-reverence of nature writing and everything is wonder. I don't know if you remember Doug Henning, the magician, but he used to always talk about wonder this and wonder that. And sometimes that's how I start to feel reading these books. Now, mainly, I'm a huge fan of
these books, meaning the
contemporary nature writing.
Yes.
But I'm a huge fan of contemporary nature writing. It's just there are moments when my eyes start to roll a little bit.
So when you see that kind of hushed tone and the wonder of it all, what passages from Walden come to mind that bring back a rowdier, less rarefied Thoreau?
Well, one we're going to touch on, obviously, is his lust to mug a woodchuck later on. And there are plenty of them where he's talking about, I've eaten a fried rat on occasion. And there's lots of other earthy passages, but there are also very schoolmarmish passages. And it's this dance between selves that's really exciting for me. I should say, by way of full confession, that I got the call to do this show on my cell phone while I was in the Walden parking lot yesterday. And I was there with the thousands, with my daughter.
Yeah.
And there are thousands. And someone was on their cell phone. I was a complete hypocrite. I was railing at them earlier. And they were saying, the reception's not too good here at this Walden Lake. So then I don't know if
the
I
can. Thousands could, streaming in pilgrimage.
And
there.
I took my daughter, who's 15 months old, down on my shoulders. And I pointed to where the cabin had been. And I said, this is where the man lived who ruined your father's life.
Made because me a nature writer.
Because of reading him at 16, I haven't been able to get off the nature habit ever since.
It is astoundingly powerful stuff. Lawrence Buell, you describe it in your very title as at the formation of American culture. What do you mean by that?
I mean in part that nature or the idea of nature, the multiple ideas of nature have been key to how Americans over history have thought about their nation and their own collective identity. We're a country that evolved with incredible rapidity from a practically undeveloped land, although we now know that Native Americans modified the landscape more than once was thought in pre-Columbian times. But the rapidity of landscape change has been amazing. And as that's happened, the once was of vast open tracts of comparative wilderness seems even more a kind of national definer. It's easy to get self-hallucinated about that. It's easy to think that we once were and still are more a country that stands for the protection of wilderness, more a country of the wide open spaces.
But there, Thoreau captured so much. We'll come back and look
there
at all that.
Did.
Lawrence Buell, Jeff Kramer, David Gessner, please stand by. We're looking at the Walden of Henry David Thoreau on the 150th anniversary of its publication. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Henry David Thoreau's Walden on the 150th anniversary of its publication and the resonance of that great American classic down through all those years. My guests tonight, Professor Lawrence Buell, Professor of American Literature at Harvard University, author of The Environmental Imagination, Jeff Kramer, curator at the Thoreau Institute at Walden Woods, and David Gessner, a nature writer and author of Sick of Nature, his latest book out in 2004. Larry Buell, we heard just before the break this reading, beautiful prose, where he's talking about time but a stream I go fishing in, and then his focus on the human being's primary tool, the mind. The intellect is a cleaver, he said. My head is an organ for burrowing. He may have been in nature, but he was very aware of himself as a human, as an active intellect.
One of the things he's trying to do in that passage is to connect the work of the mind and the work of the pen with what animals do. There are all sorts of forms of making, and he does one, and the badger does another, and they're connected with each other. There's something tricky about the oddness of that android burrower motif, as if he were a kind of badger, as I've said. It's an example of what David was talking about, the two faces of Thoreau. There's the solemnity that the passage starts with, time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. You can get very poetic and flighty and metaphysical at that point. But then there's something droll and gritty about burrowing with your head in the sand. And there are a lot of passages that have two handles like that when you read Thoreau. He talks about the enterprises that he has cherished leading up to the Walden experiment. And one of the things was watering the wild huckleberry bush, which else would have perished in dry seasons. Well, what does that mean? You're laughing. You can tell. But you have to point most student groups to that and make them think before they realize that it's not something just poetic.
He's stepping out the back of the cabin there.
Right.
My annotated Walden tells me that he actually went out with a watering can. I think not. I think he might have gone out there with another, not a burrowing organ.
That's the old annotated Walden, recently replaced.
Okay. Oh, good. Let me ask you this. He hits on so many things here. And going back and reading again, and I, like many Americans, realized sitting down to do this how long it had been since I was read, and how much, as a much younger reader, I just went right over my head. First of all, I was astonished at all the references to the world far from Walden Pond. I mean, he's constantly talking about Hindu sacred texts in the Vedas and Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita, and references to geography and wars and politics all around the world, even as you sit in Walden Pond. But on his core subject itself, I came away wondering about some of what I read. On the one hand, he writes, "We can never have enough of nature. We must be refreshed by the sight of inexhaustible vigor, vast and titanic features," and so on and so on. But then in another passage, and this is in his chapter Higher Laws, he says, "Nature is hard to overcome, but she must be overcome. What avails it that you are Christian if you are not purer than the heathen, if you deny yourself no more, if you are not more religious?" Jeff Kramer, what's going on there? The great nature lover must overcome nature? Is he saying, I, Henry David Thoreau, Christian, we, Christendom, as it were then, must overcome nature?
Well, I think there's a conception that Thoreau didn't want to touch nature, didn't ever want to change nature. He was a human being and believed that he had certain basically inalienable rights, that nature was there for his use, provided he didn't overstep his bounds. And so, I mean, he used lumber. He believed things should be cut down, and he cultivated a garden and grew vegetables. He did things with nature.
Walden itself was in its second growth of forest when he built his cabin, not virgin forest at all.
Right. So I think he was there understanding that nature was there to be used and in some ways overcome.
And yet, David Gessner, this is so far from the sort of green saint vision. Nature is hard to overcome, but she must be overcome. It's almost what protesters would march against now.
It's what I like about him. It's the double-handled thing Larry's talking about. It's that we start in one, we start with this kind of schoolmarmy Thoreau, who, you got to think of this guy was an incredibly disciplined guy, disciplined about his diet, about not drinking, about rarely, if ever, having sex. I mean, this was a very rigid man in some ways and yet completely flexible in others. And I think that's what's really interesting, is to go into a sentence expecting it to go one way and then have it go another. Not long after that and not long before, you get a totally different muddy, down-to-earth Thoreau who's a lot more fun. But it's fun to have that too, because I think one of the things that I love in first-person writers, and one of the things I'm asking for in my, we'll call it modestly a manifesto,
sick of nature,
is more personality, more character, more of the kind of Montanian aspect of Thoreau's writing, which is to say, more of the I. I mean, we've got to think. That's another aspect of the book we got to talk about, is this massive use of the first person.
Which he speaks to directly. He almost apologizes to the reader at the outset and says, I know this isn't the way things are done, but I'm going to use I because it's I who sits here, who stood here in the woods.
And you get, that's another aspect of the personality. You get that defensiveness right away. You can almost hear some adolescent responding to their father say, the father says, why do you speak about yourself so much? Or why do you use the word I? And then he comes back with the famous line, if I knew anybody else as well, so he's always got that bristling defensiveness too. And that's another thing I feel very, over the years, I feel that's still very alive. And that's part of the fun.
Two great things there. I don't want to let go of either one. Larry Buell, first on the I, and Thoreau's kind of mission and sense of himself when he went into the woods. He had lost a dear brother. He'd been a handyman for Ralph Waldo Emerson. Even if he was coming out of the woods, as you say, Jeff Kramer, and seeing other people and not a hermit, this was an unusual undertaking. What was the personal motivation? Do we have a sense of that?
It was an unusual undertaking, particularly for a college graduate before 1850. This was way before the age of the popular wilderness vacation or wilderness retreat. His behavior was downright weird. He was one of a teeny percentage of well-educated folk in his day, and for a Harvard graduate to chuck it all
and sit in the woods
and go sit in the woods for 2 years plus was a very weird thing to do. So some of his descriptions that make Walden sound as if it were over the hills and far away in Montana or the steppes of Russia, they reflect how his townsmen perceived the oddity of what he was doing.
He's very upfront about this. He says he knew the prairie. He says, this isn't the prairie. This isn't like solitude on the prairie. He said, I'm here by choice, even though I'm not so far. I'm ensconcing myself in this cul-de-sac of nature by choice, but it's not the far frontier.
In contemporary terms, what he's doing is he's getting off the escalator. He's getting off the conventional success ladder, trying to figure out what life and he himself are all about.
Did he think at that point in his life that he was a failure somehow? Was he looking for a restart? The book itself wasn't a big seller, so it's not as though he came out, on the New York Times bestseller list after this.
He was a late bloomer. He'd been trying to make it as an author without much success, experimenting around somewhat in different forms. It seems to me the easiest answer to your question is that he was trying to find himself. Erik Erikson, the great social psychologist who was a pioneer in the study of stages of life, particularly men's life, has the concept of the moratorium that some people, including extraordinary people, take in early adulthood. And that could be applied to this Walden interval, this two and a fraction years of withdrawal.
Just fantastically fruitful in these pages and in these lines. I mean, this is clearly a deeply educated man who's bringing a lot into the woods with him and then spinning it back out in a fantastic way, literary and insightful. He says here at one point, a lake, speaking to his own maybe search for himself, he says, a lake is the landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye, looking into which the beholder measures the depth of his own nature, maybe his, Thoreau's own nature.
Tom, can I interrupt for one second about that very point about the practical reasons for going to the woods?
Yeah.
I'm 43 years old, so I'm about a year shy of when Thoreau died.
He was 29 when he went to the woods.
Yeah, and I first got health insurance when I worked for Larry a year and a half ago, like at a regular job. I struggled for those. I'm not trying to glorify myself, but I struggled from when I graduated until, and I don't think that's uncommon until just recently.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's uncommon for the artist. So though it speaks to every man and every woman, the book, it also is very much to me, one thing that stays alive over 150 years is this artist who's dealing with two of the big things struggling artists deal with, which is the need for cash and the need for respect. And this is a guy who's fighting those things, and he's trying to convince himself to some degree that the life that men praise and regard as successful is but one kind, which is what he says.
And that he and his tiny cabin may be living the higher life.
And in doing so, he succeeded in convincing generations of people stealing generations of people in that kind of fight. Because, I mean, among other things, it's a practical solution to a guy who's working as a surveyor and a failed school teacher.
And so, doesn't have a lot of money, and yet he sits in this grand world, universe, essentially endless. His mind goes and goes.
Yeah, but I feel at all times that kind of wrestling match on the page, that tension of what it is to, you know, he, you know, I think we talked about Joseph Wood Crutch earlier, or Crutch, and he talks about his magisterial confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the confidence is there, but then I feel something else, too.
The justification, the self-justification going on.
Yeah.
And Larry, what about the issue of his sense of nature? How do you pull together this, we can never have enough of nature, we must be refreshed by nature, and then nature is hard to be overcome, but she must be overcome? If Thoreau could, you know, land in the middle of a, I don't know, an environmental rally or meeting today, if he could plug into the environmentalist mainstream today, what do you think he would make of the modern sense of the environment, of environmentalism that he, in effect, from great distance now, spawned?
Thoreau had only begun to realize that nature might be under siege. So he would have had to recalibrate himself somewhat to understand what contemporary environmentalism was all about. And to the extent that he saw it taking hold as a broad popular attitude, he probably would have been somewhat suspicious of it in addition, because whatever was popular, Thoreau suspected as being herd instinct. That said, I think he'd find much of today's environmentalism confirming.
And he'd surely be stunned if he could look out across that vast national landscape that he saw as largely unspoiled and see what has happened.
He'd be stunned by his own local landscape, too, in a different sort of way.
Meaning the development that's gone on right around Walden Pond, the fight that goes on even to this day about more condos being built in near proximity.
Well, yes, that partly. But partly where Thoreau squatted looks much greener, woodsier, and more pristine now than it did 150 years ago.
Because when those second-growth trees have had time to,
absolutely,
to leap skyward.
And because he squatted.
Because he squatted, and because the place has been turned into a shrine with widening and widening circles because of his memory. When he was there, Concord's woodlots were at a historic low point. It was all pasture land, and you could see great distances, and it wasn't nearly as private as it is now, despite the population surge.
So the nation might surprise him in how it's gone, but New England may be much more heavily forested today than it was in those days when they were cutting everything down to build.
It absolutely is. However, Thoreau would still be appalled by the automotive era. There's no doubt about it.
I want to get one more voice into our conversation. Bill Schechter is joining us from Brookline, Massachusetts. He's a history teacher at Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School in Sudbury, Massachusetts. He teaches a course called Meet Mr. Thoreau, and an independent study seminar course on Thoreau's Walden and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Bill Schechter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you bring Thoreau to high school students in the year 2004, 150 years after the publication of Walden. How do they take it on board? What do they make of it?
Well, I am bringing, and they are reading, and finding it very pertinent and engaging and challenging. Certainly this is a book that requires good reading skills. I'm not sure that all high school students would enjoy reading this, and probably didn't enjoy very much the cursory exposure that most high school students get to Thoreau, which means a couple days in a American Literature Survey course,
right,
in which they read, they struggle through, slog through the economy chapter.
But a difficult book. It's erudite. It has lots of references to things they may not know much about yet. It's
right.
It's deeply philosophical.
Right. And yet it does, and I think the reason they find it compelling, apart from the local angle, given that our school is located in a town that Thoreau walked around and
mm-hmm.
ate wild apples in, the connecting point is a number of issues that students themselves feel very strongly about. The preoccupation with nature, you know, which I've been listening to your conversation. Students are not very political today, but they are very strong environmentalists, so they respect that. They identify with his spiritual quest to find spirituality or God, whatever you want to call it, in nature. That's something some of them have experienced already. His complicated attitude to technology is something that is provocative for them to think about. He is the original less is more kind of guy.
He is simplify, so, simplify, simplify, he writes. And what about David Gessner's observation that he was kind of looking for permission to march to the different drummer that he describes, to be the free thinker? Do you see that in your students' eyes?
Well,
oh, hey, here's a great one saying I can go my own way and it doesn't need to be necessarily even an affluent way, and that's fine. That's good.
Well, yes, and this is very compelling because you have never dealt with a more, at least if you're dealing with a suburban population, you've never dealt with a more overscheduled generation, who bring to their studies all the anxieties of their parents and society, doing 12 different extracurricular activities, doing what other people feel they should do to get ahead. And here's this guy who speaks to them in another voice, who says, much as I am trying to find my place in the world, you can do that, and you can be extravagant in doing it, which is to say, to go beyond the bounds of what society thinks is okay or normal. And he does it. He doesn't just talk about it.
It sounds as though you're taking your high school students to a kind of refuge, a kind of a Walden Pond, right there in the classroom, Bill Schechter.
Well, we actually have a cabin at the school, but Walden Pond is only 5 minutes away. So we do enjoy some Thoreauvian activities. We go swimming at the pond early in the morning. We barge in on Jeff Cramer up at the Thoreau Institute, some, mostly announced, sometimes unannounced.
Thoreauvian activities.
And Faunter. But it does encourage kids to examine their lives.
Bill Schechter, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
David Gessner, Lawrence Buell, Jeff Cramer, stand by. We're talking tonight about Henry David Thoreau's Walden on the 150th anniversary of its publication, 1854. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Henry David Thoreau's Walden on the 150th anniversary of its publication in the mid-19th century. My guest tonight, Jeff Cramer, editor of the recently released Thoreau's Walden, a fully annotated edition. Lawrence Buell is with us. He's professor of American Literature at Harvard University and author of The Environmental Imagination, Thoreau, Nature Writing, and the Formation of American Culture. And David Gessner is here. He's editor of the forthcoming literary journal Ecotone, author of Sick of Nature, a reluctant, as he self-describes, nature writer. Let's hear a little more from Henry David Thoreau himself here, the passage David Gessner was talking about earlier, where he goes out and finds an insatiable desire to chase after a woodchuck.
As I came home through the woods with my string of fish, trailing my pole, it being now quite dark, I caught a glimpse of a woodchuck stealing across my path and felt a strange thrill of savage delight and was strongly tempted to seize and devour him raw. Not that I was hungry then, except for that wildness which he represented. Once or twice, however, while I lived at the pond, I found myself ranging the woods like a half-starved hound, with a strange abandonment, seeking some kind of venison which I might devour. And no morsel could have been too savage for me. The wildest scenes have become unaccountably familiar. I found in myself, and still find, an instinct toward higher, or, as it is named, spiritual life, as do most men, and another toward a primitive, rank, and savage one. And I reverence them both. I love the wild not less than the good. The wildness and adventure that are in fishing still recommended it to me. I like sometimes to take rank hold on life and spend my day more as the animals do.
Okay, David Gessner. Who is this guy? It's a vampire loping through the night. He wants to sink his teeth into anything with fur and warm blood.
Well, I like the way the reader said, savage delight. this is in an oversimplified version what I'm talking about. The variety of this guy, the bloodlust coming in, right, at the beginning of the chapter called Higher Laws. I mean, this is the pious chapter, and we get this contradiction right away. And I think one of the things that I've grumbled about. Now, let me just say, to play the contrarian, I could have easily written an essay about how much I love contemporary nature writing and how great it is, but it just so happened I woke up on one side of the bed and decided to rant against it.
Good for you. Thoreau might have done the same.
But one of the things I see is different parts of Thoreau getting separated out and kind of specialized. You know, so we have, we might have one kind of seeker, but often it's a very new agey spiritual seeker as a nature writer, and we get a lot of like kiss the sky and love the ground. And we're missing the woodchuck mugging.
This is the lusty savage. I don't know if he's got something sexual for this woodchuck, but he's riled up here.
Well, you know, another thing that we haven't talked about, I think in Larry at one point, and I correct me if I'm wrong, said of Emerson that he was like kind of an anti-mentor figure. So with Thoreau, we get, first of all, he's fighting against not just, you know, this fictional parent I mentioned, but he's got a mentor living. He's living on his land, for God's sake, on Emerson's land. So he's fighting against breaking free of that. And the cliche is him as the more earthier of the two. I think he says Emerson wouldn't trundle a wheelbarrow through town. When I was in thrall of Thoreau when I was writing my first book, and it ends with me kind of breaking away from him, I took mushrooms and rumbled around the marsh and chase some woodchucks of my own on Cape Cod.
A little psychedelic.
The old ladies on Cape Cod who came to my readings all said, oh, that's nice. He ate some mushrooms like he found in the woods. So, but I mean, I overdid it a little bit. But I guess in the spirit of overdoing it, I just like a little more of that Thoreau to stay alive.
Jeff Cramer, it's not as though he didn't sell any copies of this book. He sold a couple of thousand, as I recall. What was the reception that it first got? Did people think Henry David Thoreau was nutty, or were they already enthralled, inspired?
Well, some people were inspired. He got letters from people who read the book and were moved by it. There were reviews, they came out like any book, mixed reviews. There were some that just thought it was the most absurd thing they'd ever read, and then there were other reviews that praised it. And so the reception was quite mixed, but selling it was slow. It took about 5 years to sell the first printing of 2,000 copies.
And do we know what he came to think of the book in that time himself as it filtered out to the public? Was he proud? Or did he say, what came over me in those 2 years? Did he think he'd cracked open a new vista here? I mean, you've got E.O. Wilson, I'm reading recently, saying 17 years before Darwin published The Descent of Man, you had Henry David Thoreau intuitively anticipating the whole kind of evolutionary origin of humankind.
He doesn't really mention Walden very much in his writings or in his journals. When it first came out, he simply wrote in his journal, Walden published. I mean, it didn't seem to have a great personal effect on him. Now, perhaps he was proceeding cautiously because of the failure of his first book. But when he mentions it, it's just in passing as just something he had written. He doesn't refer to it in any way that makes it seem spectacular in his life.
Larry Buell, 150 years on, we still live in no small part in the framing that Henry David Thoreau built right here in that little cabin.
We do indeed. Certainly in our image of him as the man who belongs in the woods. And that cabin as an icon has been replicated in lots of different ways, from the seriousness of lifetime homesteading to the comparative ephemeral of the weekend getaway place at the lake. There are lots of Walden clones that have been written that think self-consciously about what they're doing in relation to Henry David's experiment, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, especially in the U.S., though.
He described the idol. He cultivated the heck out of it. and we're grateful for it even now. No plaster saint alive here tonight in as many dimensions. Jeff Kramer, Lawrence Buell, David Gessner, I want to thank all three of you. It's been just wonderful having you. Thanks so much for coming in. I want to go out with just a little bit more of Henry David Thoreau, this from the conclusion of Walden.
I learned this, at least, by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. He will put some things behind, will pass an invisible boundary. New, universal, and more liberal laws will begin to establish themselves around and within him. Or the old laws be expanded and interpreted in his favor in a more liberal sense. And he will live with the license of a higher order of beings. In proportion as he simplifies his life, the laws of the universe will appear less complex, and solitude will not be solitude, nor poverty, poverty, nor weakness, weakness. If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now, put the foundations under them.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We do have new and unusually specific information about where al-Qaeda would like to attack. And as a result, today the United States government is raising the threat level to Code Orange for the financial services sector in New York City, northern New Jersey, and Washington, D.C.
I've been in the city for nearly 30 years. And sort of sad to see the city reduced to this, you know, Fortress America.
Today I'm asking Congress to create the position of a National Intelligence Director. The person in that office will be appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate and will serve at the pleasure of the President.
A sting in which the government offered two men the opportunity to assist someone who they believed was a terrorist facilitator, supplying weapons to be used to commit terrorist acts.
I know they are innocent, believe me. I'm 100% sure they are innocent. This is just harassment.
Did they do this to Christian churches?
These military intelligence interrogation tactics are being used at places my client has never been. You have to ask yourself how a PFC would have gotten that information if she's never been there.
Today's employment report shows our economy is continuing to move forward, and it reminds us that we're in a changing economy, and we've got more to do.
Four out of five of the jobs that are being created are low-paying, different sectors than the ones that we want to create that give our kids a greater opportunity.
Going right out there by those boats are the main way people enjoyed the statue. But to be able to go inside, it means so much more. And to see the faces of these kids, it really meant a lot.
The Mehdi Army, which is the group that Muqtadir al-Sadr controls, apparently started attacking Iraqi police stations.
We have declared that we wish for the truce to be restored. Now it is up to the United States and those who fight with them or support them to give their view on this.
You see, my opponent is a Washington politician who's taken both sides of just about every issue, including Big Ten football.
You know... because they've only got 3 more months to
camp. And there's a week. Director of Homeland Security Tom Ridge issues targeted terror warnings for New York City, New Jersey, and Washington, responding to recommendations by the 9/11 Commission. President Bush announces plans for a national intelligence director, but not with the powers the panel recommended. Two members of a mosque in Albany, New York, are arrested in an FBI sting for alleged money laundering tied to a fictitious terrorist plot. hearings at Fort Bragg to decide whether or not there will be a court-martial for Private First Class Lindy England, accused of abusing prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Bush and Kerry spar over stunted job growth numbers out today. The base of the Statue of Liberty opens for the first time since 9/11/01. A deadly week in Iraq, fierce fighting in Najaf and the Sadr city suburb of Baghdad, and Bush and Kerry trading blows again today on the campaign trail. There it is, Jack. You can really feel the presidential campaign getting into gear this week.
Yeah, and usually this is the so-called silly season when nothing is happening and Michael Dukakis is on vacation up in the Berkshires. And
not this
right
time.
Not this time. Boy, we're not going to rest on our oars. We are out there if we're John Kerry and George Bush working day and night.
And you know, the cycle is very short. The barb that comes out in the morning is answered in the afternoon, is answered in the next hour. So we get the attack and counterattack from both directions back the other way each day.
Yes, it's a kind of debate, isn't it? I mean, we're already having the debates, and these will be the talking points that will come up in those debates, which, given the politics of the bounce, one side or another, may be the most decisive thing in this campaign, the debates, that is.
Now, the politics of the bounce, the John Kerry bounce, not so big. Lots of discussion early in the week about whether the Democratic Convention produced what he needed.
Yeah, you know, Democrats are saying, well, no, he didn't do so well in the horse race numbers, but in the metrics under, you know, commander in chief, under who will do well in Iraq, under even war on terrorism, he did very well on all of those. But the fact is, this is the month where he's had his vacation, I mean, where he's had his convention, and he's named his vice president, and he's basically gotten nothing out of it. So, you know, suppose Bush has his convention, and if he gets a sizable bump, it'll show that voters were out there available to be bounced. Only Kerry didn't bounce them. And then your question will be, well, why? Why didn't Kerry get more of a carry? And one hypothesis would be that he really didn't differentiate himself on Iraq, that seems to be the main issue for a lot of people, from the president. He didn't offer anything like an exit strategy. In fact, he tried to sound even tougher than the president.
Well, tough news out of Iraq this week. And on the economic front, the balance and polls may unleash themselves from these candidates' personalities. Job numbers out today, really miserable compared to expectations, job growth in July. And in Iraq, as we've heard the last couple of days and tonight, fierce fighting again, trouble on all kinds of fronts.
Yes, and, you know, imagine we are in Cairo, we are in, Beirut, we are in Amman, we're watching television, and what are we watching? We're seeing American helicopter gunships raining death down on guerrillas, which for our money is, well, they deserved it. But that's not how people are looking at it in the Middle East. And by gosh, every time one of these things is on, we say, well, we killed so many of them, and we're right back into the logic of Vietnam, which was body counts and killing and losing the war.
Meanwhile,
because, of course, the wars are about politics. They're not about, you know, how many of the enemy you kill.
And the message coming out of Muqtada al-Sadr's spokesman in Najaf today to the Muslim world, help us, brothers. They are destroying Najaf.
There it is.
There's the message. And yet there has to be a solution. As you say, hasn't been one articulated yet. We'll be waiting. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.